was as low as it has ever been. But not because...
There was a period, nevertheless, Regis, I remember it. presumably after the time when the chief of the Air Force would warn the minister that things are reaching a very, very critical stage, it continues to roll on. The program continues to roll on some time. But the government begins to issue sort of cautionary statements. In other words, reinforcing the agreement which said that they could cancel out, etc., etc. And this was causing considerable concern, re-morale within the Avro company and all the rest of it. There was about a year there of...
Yes, because a decision such as that is not taken either lightly or quickly. And we had to go through, once the cabinet and the PM got into the act, we had to go through all of the same exercises all over again at that level. What are the options? What can we do? Is there any way we can save this program? Can it be stretched? Now, the selling of the airplane was one of the options that came up at cabinet level. That was not something the Air Force recommended. That came up as probably came out of DDP. I can't remember who was minister for DDP at that time, defense production. But whoever it was, somebody came up and said, "Well, why don't we try and sell the airplane?" It was hooper picking. It was just grasping at straws. Really, in retrospect, at the time it was. It was just too damned important. So, when the crunch decision was made, of course, then came the next thing. How do we explain to the public that we could have started this program, let it go this far, and be literally on the edge of a great success in technology for Canada, and then say down the drain
for a couple thing. Of bucks?
Yeah, all for some money. Well, of course, what they did was they grasped two things. One was the fact that it couldn't be sold elsewhere, and therefore the program was going to be too costly for Canada.
This is where it comes in, though. This is used as an argument
for the public. Absolutely. Not realizing, the public not understanding what the cost would be even if we had sold it in 500 copies. And secondly, the other thing that came along at the same time, of course, was Bomark.
Yeah.
And therefore, with Bomark as a point defense system over the main industrial area of Canada, that there wasn't quite the same requirement for a fighter interceptor as there had been when the program was originally started. See, they tried to negate the original operational requirement that something had come along to replace it. And therefore, operationally, the fighter was no longer required.
So the key then was not to dwell on the bucks or to dwell on the requirement. It was to change the requirement itself.
Yes, because see, when you look at the bucks side, and you're in the opposition or you're the public, I'm constantly dropping that from thinking. When you're in the opposition or one of the critics of the government, money is something you're supposed to be able to manage. And it's the easiest thing in the world to pick up, because you have the budget, you have estimates, you have various programs, contracts being signed. Therefore, it's very easy to keep tab on money. You're a critic.
Mm-hmm.
And if you suddenly see that the costs are not in line with what was originally said, what was in estimates, what is turning up in budget, of course, you've just got a beautifully made platform to take off and criticize the government.
Yeah. One thing here, and I'm quoting here from my own book, page 316, you know, much of this, again, crunch is coming in 1958. Later that month and during the period until the new election in the spring of 1958, which again was a factor, Perks announced the government's intention, upon the advice of the chief of staff, to continue to support the development of the CF-105. "The best advice that I have," he told the House, "founded on the judgment given by our own military advisors from our NATO partners, is that for many years to come, there will be manned bombers. He felt, however, that if an attack came, it would be a combination of intercontinental missiles and manned bombers. Questioned again in January 58 about the Arrow, he was slightly more hesitant, but answered that, quote, the future of that aircraft will depend entirely on the nature of the threat. The matter is constantly under examination, and as long as the threat exists, development and production of the CF-105 will continue. He was also careful to state that the program might be cancelled should the situation warrant it. Now, this again, he continues to utter this during 58. Then I go on saying during 58 he found himself in an increasingly difficult position. For a variety of reasons, many connected with the desire to make the Arrow the most efficient weapon in an era of rapidly changing technology, the cost of the aircraft continued to escalate. Originally, it had been estimated that the aircraft, when developed, would cost about $1 million per unit, or about 25% more than the CF-100. By the end of 58, that estimate had quintupled to at least $5 million per aircraft, and that, of course, did not include the huge sums the government had paid towards its development. It also did not include the cost of the missiles each plane would carry, nor the extensive guidance control network which would have to be established throughout the area where the aircraft was expected to operate. Despite the obvious excellence of the Arrow, the financial burden of trying to develop and produce an aircraft which hitherto only the major nations could afford was becoming unbearable. Now, again in 1958, in July, Perks goes to Washington, talks to John Foster Dulles and all that sort of thing, tries to at least tell them that, you know, Canada's doing everything it can, but this is a big item for us. Can't they take a slice of the action? There's mention here of the aircraft being equipped with the American Sparrow air-to-air missile. Then Canada building more radar stations, get the Bomark, install Sage, etc., etc. It would mean that the costs were rising, that Canada would be spending more money in the States, and again, would they not buy the aircraft? He went again in August 58 to talk to the American Secretary of State for Defense, Neil McElroy, about the possibilities of them getting the aircraft, and he left there, quote, little encouraged. By this time, the United States itself was developing an advanced supersonic aircraft with many features of the Arrow, and the aircraft industry's lobbyists in Washington were a very powerful group. And then, of course, you have Sputnik. And then, to push it along a little bit further, the House of Commons Standing Committee on Estimates, considering the 58-59 estimates of the DND and defense production, the committee, although taking back the $175 million set aside for the CF-105 program, reluctantly concurred in the need of the money, but expressed concern about the government entering into any subsequent weapons program, quote, without first negotiating for some cost-sharing agreement with either NATO member countries or the USA under the NORAD agreement. Perks returned to Ottawa to answer questions in the House, admitted the dilemma in which he was placed. By this time, in fact, up to the end of the previous fiscal year, $220 million had been spent on the Arrow. The additional $175 million allocated for further research would carry on the program until 31 March 59. Although, as he noted, quote, and speaking in the House, we have the right to discontinue it at any time. So it's getting into 58, 59. And then again, talking about the pressure on Perks. We were besieged by the AV Row people. If the Arrow was to continue, Perks had to have more money. But working with a limited defense budget, he faced this problem of either reducing the effectiveness of the other two services or admitting that the expensive program must be halted. He might have demanded more millions for defense, but his arguments would have been questionable, and he was well aware of the needs of the other departments to implement many of the measures the Conservatives had promised. To scrap the Arrow completely would be a risk, but a first step had to be taken, and a last strong effort could be made to find buyers before the final decision. And then, yeah. And then it's in, at this time, of course, that...
Let me perhaps explain a couple more things, when you were reading those, it brought a couple of things to mind. When I talked about the options that we had, and I said one of them was to stretch the program, we were basically forced to do that. Because we knew that the money was going to run away with us, and we weren't going to have that kind of money, we then had to issue orders to slow down this development. In other words, instead of running full speed ahead, here's how much money you're going to have for development over the next 6 months, and you're going to have to stay within it. You can't. It's not. We don't know how you're going to do it, but that's your problem. Don't spend more money than that. And the other thing is that this was always research and development program, and we never did get beyond, I think it was 10 prototypes that authority in principle to build 10 airplanes. I don't know how many we actually finally turned out, but the program never was for more than 10 airplanes, which is nothing more than a development program. In any modern system, weapon system, you actually build a minimum of 10, which then are allocated, destructive testing, various tests of all kinds, and you might recover perhaps half of those as operational machines. The others may be in bits and pieces by the time you finish the rest of your development program. So it's really a pre-production order is what we're talking about. And all these costs that we're talking about are all related to a pre-production run of 10 airplanes. Now, the logistics of a major program are such that at the time, when we were getting near the end of this program, we had reached the point where we had to start ordering the long lead time items for the production run of 100 airplanes. And we never did receive that authority. And it was that kind of money, on top of what you've already got there, this is all development money, that was putting the program, and this is what I say, when we were doing this, and this was part of my job, and with the logistics people, and this is where the curve was just going crazy, straight up.
Like the aircraft.
That's right, straight up. And we had reached the point, some of the long lead time items, some of the lead times, we're talking in terms of 18 months, 2 years. And therefore, you had to order that stuff if you were going to have a line going and not hiccup and not stop, just like anything. You've got long lead time items. You must order them. And to order, when you're ordering, people want money.
Yeah.
And so there it is. They want ongoing payments to cover the cost of what they're doing, or they certainly want a letter of intent. And once they get down that road, if cancellation, and your cancellation charges quite often are more than the cost of actually proceeding to finish out the production run. Quite often, there are more. And so you thank God we never did, in hindsight, thank God we never did get into the ordering of the lead time items for the production run, because then it would have been even more money would have gone down the drain.
Yeah.
But I think the figure was 10, but it was something like that. Maybe it was 8. But it was a pre-production run, and that was all that Cabinet had authorized. So it perhaps helps to put the costs in context again. That we are talking about just all the money that's being spent, and that's why he said continue the development. He said continue the development. He didn't talk about production. He's talking about development. And that sort of thing. But again, the tragedy was that it was such a beautiful machine. What was it on its second flight? It went through the sound barrier.
Yeah,
which was staggering. Yeah. Now that was partly pressure.
That
test pilot. The point was that the machine was already in trouble. It had to be proven quickly, and I don't know who authorized him to go through the sound barrier on his second flight on an airplane, but someone took that decision. Because God Almighty, but it worked. It worked beautifully. And then, of course, about its fifth or sixth flight, it went through Mach 2, which no one had done. It was an incredible, beautiful piece of engineering.
Wasn't the sad part today is that they're looking for an aircraft now in 78 that is the features, the quality.
Absolutely. If that bird had gone and gone into production, we would probably still be flying it today. Or certainly variations of the theme.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, again, I
see here.
Oh, hindsight, 20/20 vision.
Yeah. We're talking again about the fall of 1958, and it's talking about the various things, and I'm on page 319 of my book.
That's the first one.
Yeah. With the introduction of the Bomark as part of Canada's anti-bomber defences, fewer manned supersonic interceptor aircraft would be needed, and thus, quote, the government had decided that it would not be advisable at this time to put the CF-105 into production, quote.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
However, the impact on the aircraft industry if the development of the Arrow was discontinued abruptly, together with the uncertain international outlook, made the government decide as, quote, a measure of insurance, quote, the development program for the aircraft with its Iroquois engine should be continued until March 59, when the situation would be reviewed. Contracts for the Astro fire control system,
right, that's right,
and
that's
the Sparrow right. missile, however,
okay, I'll come to that in a minute,
were to be terminated and modifications made to allow a substitution of a fully developed missile and control system, which would save a considerable amount of money. Nevertheless, even with this saving, up to the end of September 58, the Arrow had cost $303 million. To finish, and I quote here, to finish this development of the CF-105 and its components, including the Astra and Sparrow, the press release noted, and to produce enough to have about 100 aircraft for squadron use, would cost about another $1.25 billion. Now, these are $1.25 billion in 1958 dollars.
Yeah, yeah.
Would you like to mention anything about the Astra and Sparrow?
Billion?
No, $1.25 billion.
$1.25 billion,
yeah. And as you say, those were in 58 dollars. And while our budgets were fairly healthy in those days, that was the equivalent of the Air Force budget, I think,
yeah.
for at least 1 year, the total budget.
Yeah.
Yes, the Astra was this weapons system, that is the electronics part of the weapons system, which included the dish for the airborne interception and all the electronics, which at that time, as I say, was state of the art and was superb equipment, and it had come along with just the odd hiccup, like I mentioned, the dish and a few other things like that. Now the Sparrow, the Velvet Glove, was a DRB development. And the Sparrow was an American one. The Sparrow is still used today in the United States. It'll take a nuclear warhead, the Sparrow. But the requirement was for a Canadian-built missile, if we could get it. Now, the Velvet Glove was coming along beautifully. Sparrow really was a backup system in case the Velvet Glove fell flat in its face.
Mm-hmm.
And we had no way of knowing. No way at all of knowing whether Velvet Glove. Now, if Velvet Glove turned out well, it was being designed for the 105. It would fit the system beautifully. No trouble at all. It was just a question of would it work, and that shows you how much confidence we had in DRB. They had never done anything like this before, and as it turned out, it worked. It was great. It was superb. Yeah. And if we had gone on, then Sparrow would have gone down the drain. We wouldn't have needed Sparrow. It would have been the Velvet Glove. But again. Cost. It was costing a lot of money. Whereas the Sparrow, they were getting ready to sell the Sparrow on a production run. And the Americans, and gosh, remember this, in so much of the stuff that we bought from the Americans and have bought from the Americans, we have never paid a cent of the development costs. What we've paid has been off the production line cost. And the Americans often have said to us, And I have sat in on conferences where they said, now the unit cost will be so-and-so, but we must add to that X amount of millions because that is a proportion of the development cost. And we've all just sat there and shuddered. And then after another hour of discussion, finally got the Americans to agree to not charge us for the development cost. Purely and simply on the basis, you developed it anyway for your own requirement. All we're going to do is please get a handout, and not once did they charge us for development costs, but they were absolutely right. Theoretically, we should have picked up a part of the production of the development cost, and of course that was where the Sparrow became a much more economical buy, because we didn't have to pay for the production of it, the development of the thing.
Yeah. Well, again, in the latter part of 1958, Perks is doing his damnedest to do some selling. In December 1958, at the NATO meeting of defense ministers, Canada was told finally and definitely that the USA would not purchase the Arrow. 2 months later, a similar reply, that would be February 59, a similar reply was received from Great Britain. The cost of the aircraft, the demands of their own aircraft industries, the delays in production, and the uncertainty surrounding the role of the manned interceptor versus the coming generation of missiles were some of the main arguments. AV Roll Company, of course, does everything that it possibly can, leaping up and down to convince the government that it must continue on. And then comes the time. Skipping over to page 321, at the same time, everything pointed to the need to cancel. Early in 59, intelligence estimated that 2 years after the Arrow became operational, the Russians would have about 750 ICBMs and SLBMs. Now, of course, that's the great false missile gap. The Arrow, let's see now, in any event, Perks, and I quote him, says later, to continue the Arrow program would have meant the cessation of any naval development which was going on, and we could not have begun to have re-equipped the Army with any modern weapons. And it would have meant very serious reductions in the strength of the Army. It would have been all out of proportion. I could never have felt that I was justified in cutting the other services to the extent which would have been necessary to buy the Arrow. Many RCA officers would like to have seen the Arrow developed. On the other hand, there were many who felt as I did, that perhaps we should concentrate more on missiles. But the chiefs of staff as a whole considered this matter so carefully, and I took the collective advice of the chiefs of staff. At that time, they felt that the balance of defense was necessary, and if more money wasn't available, then we would have to make some other arrangements, these being that there would be fighters from the American forces. I think that the decision to cancel the Arrow was the hardest decision I had to make while I was Minister of Defense, and I don't back down on the decision that I did make. I think it was a wise decision. It was undoubtedly unpopular in certain quarters, but it hurt national pride. But we had to provide the best defense we could with the money that we had. And then, of course, the decision is announced by Diefenbaker in February 59. And of course, the decision, as he says, and from what you say, was made on the advice of the
absolutely. Oh yes,
of the chief. Of staff.
Sure. And it had to start with the chief of the air staff. He was the one who had to raise it first, and it was from that little group that I had working with that when we finally saw the red light,
yeah,
and knew that something had to be done, and that was I don't think I ever had an experience as grim as that as facing the chief. And literally telling him that the program had to be canceled. And you don't tell Hugh Campbell that kind of thing. You stand back 10,000 yards and wait for them,
write
wait
the letter.
Wait for them to start to drop on you, you know. But I must admit, in fairness to Hugh Campbell, I think he knew that the thing, he never had it actually put to him, but I think he realized in his own mind that the thing was getting out of control and was already concerned about it. And probably if we hadn't come forward when we did, he probably would have asked for it,
yeah,
very soon after, and simply had us in and said, this program I'm worried about now. I want a full-blown briefing, thorough forecast on everything, and I don't want any cover-ups. I want God's truth,
yeah,
as you people see it. And then we're talking about it. So it was all coming to a head. I mean,
yeah,
I don't mean to imply that we found experts who suddenly uncovered something that nobody else felt. It was there, but we were the ones who finally grasped the nettle,
yeah,
and ran with it and put
everyone
it forward.
Everyone else trying to avoid it.
Everyone else was really, as you say, trying to avoid it, procrastinating, doing everything to keep that program going, hoping somehow that there would be a miracle.
I gather the feeling at NDHQ when it was cancelled, especially among the Air Force officers, must have been
Oh, it was terrible. It took years to recover from that situation. A lot of effort was spent on that program, as you can imagine. Masterminding that program, every cell, in headquarters had a number of people who had worked on that program for years, done nothing else but work on that program. And all of a sudden, chop, their job was gone. And all those years of effort that they put in was for nothing, absolutely nothing. And there are a lot of very devoted aeronautical engineers, supply people, logistics people, operational people, and suddenly it was...
Yeah, the bottom dropped.
That's just nothing. Oh, yeah, it was terrible. Terrible.
Did they all run to the States, or is that just myth?
I'm sorry?
Did they all leave?
Oh, no. We didn't lose any from the Air Force. No.
The Avro
people did, yes. Oh, a lot of Avro people went south, of course, because the big space programs were being cranked up in the States, and there was an enormous demand for the kind of technology which these people had developed.
Yeah.
And of course, they were at the, and I say again, the state of the art.
Yeah.
They were superb people, scientifically and from an engineering point of view, the top. And of course, when that program collapsed, here was NASA and the various companies in the U.S. looking for that caliber of man. And of course, they had no trouble getting jobs. They were picked up places.
Well, there was tremendous political reaction, of course, and at that time, in your position, you wouldn't be... Well, you'd remember it, but I don't
know.
No, think,
well, once the decision was made, I went and hid.
Once the decision was made, what?
I went and hid when the decision
was made. How much hiding was there, seriously?
Not much. The people who had been in on the know on the program, I was the butt of a couple of some pretty caustic remarks by some senior people who had not known all the ins of the program. About mismanaging the program, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You've done the service, the Air Force, a great disservice in this. Without really, it was just emotion.
Yeah.
That was pure emotion.
You still get that today.
Yeah, I suppose.
You talk to a former Air Force officer about the Arrow.
Yeah.
You know, wow!
Yeah. Yeah.
that is still
true.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah,
but
you
talked
to my 84-year-old grandma.
Yeah.
Well, one thing that frequently comes up, of course, is what happened to the prototypes of the Arrow.
Yes. Well, I don't know. Other than the fact that, of course, the word came out from Diefenbaker to scrap them. But the Air Force never did own any of those airplanes. See, they were all owned by the company and by the Defense Production. No airplane had ever been handed over to the Air Force. So they were all not under DND control, they were under DDP control. And so the order that came out to destroy them from Diefenbaker went to Defense Production, not to National Defense. Because, see, again, they were development airplanes. And we were funding it with DDP, but DDP were managing our funds, if I can put it that way.
Yeah.
Because that was the way the government worked. And we were working, of course, in Norway. But DDP had a hell of a big shop working on the Arrow, just as we did.
Who was the head of DDP at that time?
I can't remember.
Yeah,
I just can't remember. Didn't George, from around Trenton, Gorgeous George, the conservative, George Mustache.
Yeah.
He's.
Yeah.
I think George Hees was DDP then, I think. But I may be wrong, but we'd have to research it to find out.
Yeah.
And I can't even remember who the heck the deputy minister was at that time either, who, of course, became...
Yeah.
Oh, God, the meetings I sat in his office, too, trying to thrash something out of this. And, oh, dear, hours and hours and hours and hours. And all of it, knowing full well that the handwriting was on the wall, and it was just... All we were doing was rehashing the dead body. That's all we were doing.
Turning over.
Well,
at this time also, to leave the Arrow for the present, and we'll have to fold up in a couple of minutes, but just as sort of a lead-in to the next date, were you not also developing the Argus aircraft?
Yes. Well, there are a lot of programs that were underway at that time.
Yeah.
When I was in Director of Air Plans and Programs, all sorts of them. And there are several that I
couldn't talk to. Yeah.
Yes, and want to talk
to. Well, I think
because I'm, and there may be a bit of an overlap here, because I went from DAPP in 1960. I was promoted to Air Commodore and became Chief of Plans and Intelligence. So in that period between January 1956 right through to June of 1961, I was in the plans shop. And some of the things which I initiated when I was in the programming, in plans and programs, and as a director, of course I was still either implementing or handling when I became chief of plans and intelligence. They were sort of ongoing things, or things that were initiated and hadn't reached fruition. They did when I became chief of plans and intelligence. So this period that we're talking about goes really from 1956, early 56, right through to the summer of 1961. So we're talking about quite a long stretch. Yeah. And during that time period, there were many major programs. The Arrow just happens to be the emotional one. There were other emotional ones, but we succeeded. There are several very important programs that came out at that time, and some rather interesting little anecdotes as well.
But here again, you know, there's a lot written on the Arrow and all that sort of thing, but these other things I'll have to rely on more completely on you.
Sure.
Well, what do you say we make a date for next time?
Okay.